From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to the world's most listened to late night talk show, Coast to Coast AM. Here's what's happening. Maybe because I'm a grandfather, again, these stories seem to pop out at me, but government safety officials have now announced a recall of more than 500,000 drop-side cribs sold at Bye Bye Baby, Kmart, Walmart, and other stores after the death of three infants. If you have bought one of these cribs for your new baby or for someone you care about, listen to this story. The Consumer Product Safety Commission says plastic hardware on Generation 2 worldwide and Child Designs cribs can break and allow the drop side to detach. In addition, the mattress supports can break away from the crib frames. Both defects create gaps where a small child can be trapped, suffocate, or strangle. The agency has received three reports already of children who have died after getting trapped in gaps between the drop sides of their cribs and their mattresses. These cribs were made overseas. Toyota said it is recalling 437,000 Prius and other hybrid vehicles worldwide now to fix brake problems, the latest in a string of embarrassing safety lapses at the world's largest automaker. They will not stay the world's largest automaker if they keep this up. With the Prius announcement, the number of vehicles recalled globally now by Toyota has ballooned to 8.5 million, including for those with floor mats that can trap gas pedals, faulty gas pedals that are slow to return to the idle position. The 2010 Prius wasn't part of the earlier recalls. It is now. There have been 200 complaints in Japan so far and the U.S., so they're trying to get these fixed as soon as possible. India has deferred the commercial cultivation of what would have been its first genetically modified vegetable crop due to safety concerns. The environment minister there said more studies are needed to ensure genetically modified products and foods were safe for consumers and the environment. In our last hour of the program tonight, Jeffrey Smith joins us. He's a best-selling author and expert on the dangers of GM-type foods. We'll be checking in with him. Lingering residue from tobacco smoke, which clings to upholstery, clothing, and the skin, apparently releases cancer-causing agents. Scientists here at Berkeley have run lab tests, and they found substantial levels of toxins on smoke-exposed material. They say while banishing smokers to outdoors cuts secondhand smoke, residues will follow them back inside, and this third-hand smoke could harm you. Opponents call it laughable. They said this is designed to frighten people. That's all. How about being frightened? Horrified parents and politicians in Italy are asking that children there be barred from scary movies like Paranormal Activity, following reports of viewers suffering panic attacks, irregular heartbeats, trembling, and vomiting.
What's happening to me?
Sing out the message.
If it's not a ghost, what is it?
And while the scare alert may be a publicist's dream, officials such as the Italian defense minister say, we want restrictions for the children on seeing this low-budget phenomenon. The $15,000 movie, which tells the story of a couple who became increasingly disturbed by a possible demonic presence in their house, has already made in the pocket $66 million worldwide. Sad news out of Haiti again. Haiti's government has now raised the death toll from its January 12th earthquake to 230,000 people dead, and they say more bodies remain unaccounted for. The government initially estimated 150,000 dead on January 24th, apparently from bodies being recovered in the rubble of collapsed buildings in Port-au-Prince, the capital that was near the epicenter. The new figure gives the quake the same death toll as the 2004 Asian tsunami, so it appears it will go beyond that. Snow blew across the Midwest on Tuesday and headed for the hard-hit area of the Mid-Atlantic region, where federal government offices have been closed since last week and utility workers are struggling there to restore power already knocked out by a weekend blizzard. The The latest storm that hit the Midwest closed schools, greeting commuters with slick, slushy roads from Minneapolis and Chicago to Louisville, Kentucky. Hundreds of flights canceled at Chicago's airports as the storm moved across Illinois, where up to a foot of snow was forecast. Huge, powerful winds and snow could leave as much as 20 more inches of new snow in Washington, 18 near Philadelphia. New York City announced that students would have a rare snow day Wednesday, only the third in 6 years. I used to love those snow days in Detroit. I just couldn't wait for it to snow. Robert Felix, author of Not by Fire, But by Ice. Robert's getting a little too common factor here to bring you on the show all the time. Too much bad weather.
Oh, my gosh, George. It's just horrible, isn't it, for so many people right now.
Wasn't Robert Kennedy Jr. just has been saying that the climate out there on the East Coast has been so docile lately that there's no snow, there's nothing. Well, now what's he going to say?
I think that's changing right now. I watched Mayor Bloomberg today as he was talking about 12 to 15 inches of snow hitting New York City, and they'll pretty well shut things down, I would say.
I think so, too. Now, look, you have been saying for years, I mean years that I've been talking to you, that we're in the beginning stages of an ice age. Your book, Not by Fire, But by Ice, attests to that. Look, it's getting colder. We're getting more snows. I don't know what it's going to be like next year, but this has been one heck of a winter. And I remember you and I predicted this in the summer, saying that this could be one of those winters.
Yes, well, the El Nino, I think, is part of it. But yes, I've been saying since the 1990s that we're headed into an ice age, not global warming. And, you know, at first I was being laughed at, but I don't think I'm being laughed at quite as much now. It's amazing, and this is not happening just in the United States. This is happening just in the last few days. Dublin's had the biggest snowstorms in 45 years. Mongolia, 1.7 million animals killed, buried in the snow. Record snows in China, in Ireland, and in Bulgaria right now. In Romania and Bulgaria, there are 5 villages cut off by snow. So, yeah, I fear that it's beginning.
Here we go. Thanks, Robert. Robert's website linked up on our Twitter feed, which you can find at coasttocoastam.com. Oscar-winning actor Louis Gossett Jr., I like him, says he's being treated for prostate cancer. Gossett says this disease was caught early. He expects to make a full recovery. The 73-year-old actor says he's going public about this disease because there is not enough emphasis in the African-American community on fighting it with preventative examinations and early treatment. Gossett has appeared in dozens of films. He won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in 1983 for his portrayal of the no-nonsense Navy flight school sergeant who whips Richard Gere into shape in An Officer and a Gentleman.
What's your name, boy?
Mayo. Zach Mayo, sir.
How did you slip into this program? I didn't know the Navy was so hard up.
The Navy's never hard up. His memoir, An Actor and a Gentleman, is scheduled to be published this year. Tommy, let's get Lou Gossett Jr. on the show once that book comes out. Relatives in eastern Cuba claim to have held a 125th birthday party for a woman, but it's not clear if she's really that old. The state-run news agency reported on the party. The Guinness Book of World Records says it's never heard of the case. The highest fully authenticated age was 122 years old, 164 days by a woman who died in 1997 in France. Do you know the name Charles Fort? Well, you will when we're done with this in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Jim Steinmeier has worked behind the scenes with well-known magicians developing material for their performances and creating special effects for Broadway shows. He's also a historian of magic. His previous books, Hiding the Elephant and The Glorious Deception, detail the colorful magicians and how they develop their secrets. His latest work, Charles Fort, The Man Who Invented the Supernatural, a biography of a controversial American writer who collected and chronicled the oddities of our world and defined our modern view of the paranormal. Here's Jim Steinmeier. Hey, Jim, how are you?
It's great to be here, George. Thank you very much. Thanks for the introduction.
Always a pleasure. Lisa was telling me you got to catch an early plane in the morning, too. So you're all over the place. Huh?
I should be fine. I'm actually on the East Coast. I was just working on a show.
Super, super. Let me ask you a little bit about magic. We've got 3 hours with you tonight,
sure.
Jim. So let's talk about that. These magicians fascinate me. The Chris Angels and people like that who just mesmerize us. How do they do this?
Well, you know, it's really an old art. It's a very, very old art that keeps getting invented and reinvented and reinvented. And in fact, another book that I just worked on, it was published by Taschen, which was a European company, which is a history, an illustrated history of magic. And I was one of the authors who contributed to it. It was just published this last year. And it has over 500 years of magic history in it, in terms of art, in terms of just art images. Images of magicians, posters that were used by magicians, engravings. It's such an old art, and it's constantly being reinvented. And every new generation of magicians reinvents the form. And it's a very tricky way of doing it, no pun intended, because what happens is that these very basic ideas, these really appealing illusions in magic, whether it's levitation or something being produced or made to disappear, they're being dusted off, and they're being changed a little bit, but still there's always a fairy tale element of it. There's always a kind of essential element to these illusions that makes it interesting for an audience. And those don't change. And you can see this through the history of magic, that there are essential parts that always intrigue an audience, just like there are always good stories that can be told over and over and over again in different forms.
Remember when Harry Houdini made an elephant disappear in London? How did he do that?
He did that. He did it. I'm going to correct you and say it was in New York. And the reason the reason I say that is because he only did it for a short run at the Hippodrome, and then he did it a little bit after that at another theater in New York. He did it it was one of the very few kind of big magic tricks that he did during his career. Actually, Houdini was known during his time as an escape artist to most of the public, and
that's really
how he became successful. He was a great historian of magic and a collector of magic, and he was a skillful magician, but he wasn't really known by the public as a magician through most of his life. And one of those great feats was that he made an elephant disappear.
How'd he do it?
Oh, George.
Come on, Jimmy, tell me.
You know what? I'll give you a hint. One of the amazing things, one of the fun things was to research, was that it wasn't his trick. It was a trick that was sold to him by a British magician named Charles Morrett. And Charles Morrett was the guy who came up with the way that you could actually make an elephant disappear. And he sold it to his friend Houdini. And it was an optical illusion. It was one of these tricks that you know, you had to have all the elements exactly right on the stage in order to make it work.
And when you say optical illusion,
I'm talking about, you know, something grand, like, you know, involving the scenery and the props and everything else. It wasn't as simple as opening up a trap door.
No, I don't think so. But no. See, it's amazing. Remember the movie The Illusionist?
Absolutely.
That one too. That was what I call great magic. That made you scratch your head and go, how do they do this?
You know, last year I was able to work with Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus, and they have a show that's out right now. It's out in the second year, and it's a circus called Zing Zang Zoom, which is their Red Unit Circus, and it's playing arenas. And in that show, we vanish an elephant every night. And, of course, in the circus, it's a little harder because you're doing it in the center of an arena with people all around you.
And what do you do if the elephant goes nuts?
Oh, those are fantastic elephants. The elephants in the circus are fantastic elephants. It's the performers that go nuts. It's not the elephants.
I mean, they could still make an elephant disappear if he's
absolutely
a little unruly?
They do every night at Ringling Brothers, and then sometimes two and three performances a day. There's a great, great magician there that I worked with, Alex Ramon, who's in charge of all of that, is the main performer there, and is responsible for it. Does a sensational job.
Just my luck to do the body saw cutting bit, and it won't work.
Well, you have to make sure it works before you try that. Yeah,
absolutely. Anyway, on to your other work, fascinating work on Charles Fort.
Oh, thanks.
Tell me about this guy. I mean, this is an individual who led a very bizarre life. Terrible poverty when he was young. He'd get depressed a lot. Tell me about Charles.
He's a really curious character. And what was appealing to me is he's really a fascinating. It's a fascinating human story. I think the principal interest, the reason we remember him today, is that Charles Fort wrote four books, four thick books about oddities. And they really were groundbreaking at the time. No one had approached these subjects in this way, and certainly no one had approached it with the attitude that he brought to it. And I would even say that since that time, no one has quite been able to approach it with the attitude. And in these four books, this canon of Charles Fort, he was one of the first people to bring to light a wide variety of subjects of oddities. I mean, he danced over these subjects very rapidly, but he had thousands and thousands of notes and citations about these that he had taken out of scientific journals in libraries. I mean, his sources were meticulous, and he went over hundreds of years of accounts and research and collected these notes, and he was really one of the first people to write about. I'll give you a brief list of examples that are in his book.
Sure.
He was one of the first to write about UFOs. That was, of course, before those initials were coined or before the word flying saucers were coined. But he wrote about spaceships or some kind of vessels in the skies and speculated about them. He wrote one of the kind of famous, several of the famous Fortean phenomena, because it sort of fit his offbeat sense of humor, were frogs falling from the sky.
I remember that story.
Rains of frogs falling from the sky, fish falling from the sky. And Fort had hundreds of accounts of this. It isn't one account happening once, like some kind of strange news story. There were many accounts in scientific journals about this.
He claimed that somehow these creatures, these objects, got collected in a sea, right?
Well, now, you see, this is where it gets tricky, is what Fort claimed. Because the big question that over all of this is what Fort actually believed and whether he had theories that purported to answer any of these questions.
Right.
He definitely writes theories in his books, but you at times you say he's kidding. At times it's very hard to know, and even readers at the time didn't know whether certain things he was writing about you should take seriously. Now, the phenomena are always documented and are always serious. But what Fort believed is another question. And the way I explain it is that Fort is the agnostic's agnostic. He's the skeptic's skeptic. And what I mean by that is, you know, when people use the word skeptic today, certainly within your world, what that means is, it doesn't mean skeptical. It means skeptical about the same things that I'm skeptical about.
Right.
That's how people use the word skeptic. Fort was skeptic, was a skeptic. But Fort was equally a skeptic about religion, science, astronomy, Einstein, Newton, great thoughts, philosophy, the latest thing you read in the paper, and fish falling from the sky.
Until he could prove it.
Until he can prove it. And he put all of those, and he writes this, he has really entertaining ways of writing about this, and I think he's just a fascinating read. It's really, as one reviewer said at the time when he read his book, it's like riding a comet, reading Charles Fort.
Well, your book is called Charles Fort, The Man Who Invented the Supernatural, and then Charles Fort's books are called The Book of the Damned, New Lands, Low, and Wild Talents. Those were the four big ones, right?
Those were the four big ones. And actually, the publisher who did my book, Jeremy Tarcher Penguin, was nice enough when we did this biography of Fort, they republished his four books in one volume, which had been collected before with an index. And they're out now in a really nice paperback edition called The Book of the Damned. They've named it after his first book, which was his most famous book.
When he was a boy, he was into being a naturalist. He collected seashells. He loved birds. He seemed like a science guy when he was a kid, didn't he?
He absolutely did. He always had obsessions that were very close to science and collecting. And certainly when he started his writing career, you can see that he kind of transferred that sort of scientific analysis of writing to collecting. He collected slips of paper with interesting images on them, and then he started collecting interesting facts. And gradually this grew into this collection, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, of over 40,000 tiny little notes full of oddities that he had collected from the New York Public Library, principally the New York Public Library and the British Museum, in years and years of study.
All right, well, stay with us, Jim. We're going to take this quick break, then we're going to come right back with you as we talk about the life of Charles Fort. You may know it as Fortean, right? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, this weekend I met David Sarnoff Jr. He's the grandson of David Sarnoff, who was the founder of NBC. It was kind of neat, indeed. When we come back, we'll be talking with Jim Steinmeier about the life of Charles Fort, the man who invented the supernatural. What was so fascinating about Charles Fort, Jim, is he was coming out at a point where radio was starting. There was no television. Reading books was the big thing in that day, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And he really was a literary phenomenon. I mean, it had a huge impact in that market because these books, there had never been anything like these books before. They were, as someone said, they were nonfiction thrillers. They were books about our natural world that terrified people. They were ghost stories about the real world. And it was a completely new literary sensation. One of his very good friends and defenders over the years was Theodore Dreiser, the novelist. And because of that, Fort had a lot of connections to literary circles and was discussed by all the great authors and reviewers of the day. I mean, the books created a phenomenon, and they're really, in many ways, haven't been, although they've been imitated, and he established a style, which is why I call it the man who invented the supernatural. There really has been no equal to Fort's books in all the years since.
It didn't come easy for him, though, did it?
No, not at all. He really was a kind of sad, abused child in Albany, the son of a fairly wealthy wholesale grocer in Albany, who was really miserable, really self-conscious in school, left school early, and became a newspaper reporter. He had a very adventurous series of years as a young man. He traveled the world on pennies a day, on a very small amount of money, deliberately to gather experiences for a writing career. And he wrote short stories for a little while that were in newspapers, kind of pulp magazines and newspapers. He wrote kind of amusing or kind of unexpected short stories. And he had some success in that and then tried writing novels. But he was a frustrated writer all through his early career. And it wasn't until he really kind of came across this new way of writing a book, and it came out of his research in the library, these obsessive research trips to the New York Public Library, where he started studying philosophy, and then that got him interested in another subject, in mathematics, and then that got him interested in science. And as he started going through these subjects, he found anomalies. He found things that didn't make sense.
Did they interest him, or was he writing because he thought maybe people would be interested in this?
Certainly, initially, he didn't know what to do with this material. While his research came out of interest in finding subjects for writing, it's clear that when he really started gathering these subjects, he didn't know how he was going to use these strange facts, these oddities. And he started to identify, I mean, what the Book of the Damned, his first book, really proposes is that there are damned facts. There are facts that we are not told about. And they are excluded. And the things become real by excluding other things.
That's still happening to us now.
Absolutely. Well, no. I mean, it's a really interesting philosophical point that he says that, you know, things become more real by excluding other things. And so science becomes more real by tossing overboard things you don't want to talk about. And he, what he basically said was, look, I have in these shoeboxes, he didn't write this in his first book, but this is how he had gathered the information, these notes that I've gathered of things that are being ignored. And what was really amazing about his process was that he started writing. There are two lost Fort manuscripts.
And what do you mean lost? How do we know lost? How do we know he even wrote them?
That's exactly right. He wrote two books, and we know he wrote them because they were submitted to publishers, and Theodore Dreiser read them and commented on them in a number of letters.
Okay.
He wrote a book called X, and and then he wrote a book called Why. And Dreiser was convinced that X would be a sensational best-selling book and tried to sell it. And while it was at publishers, Fort wrote a second book called Why. And what those books, what we think those books basically were his first uses of these oddities and phenomena. But the mistake at that time that Fort was doing was he was trying to account for them. In other words, he was trying to posit a theory that accounted for all these things. And it seems that for instance, in X, he had a kind of wild theory that we are being controlled by another planet, that there are forces that control us from outside.
Isn't that amazing he would think that in those days?
It really is fascinating, yeah. Because it was such a leap of speculation to take these tiny facts of oddities. And what he realized is that you would look for evidence of this by looking for small oddities that don't quite fit our world. And he had a way of backing into this research by looking at this grand theory. So, you know, X was clearly some kind of science fiction speculative theories bolstered by real facts, bolstered by, more theory. And he combined it with bits of philosophy, and he quibbled over scientific theory. And we know all of this because of letters between Dreiser and Fort and Dreiser's later descriptions of these manuscripts. And after these books didn't sell, and they didn't sell, for exactly the reasons you'd think, they were sent to major publishers, and the publishers scratched their heads, and they say, what is this? It's not a science book. It's not fiction. It's not, we don't know what to do with this. And Dreiser was frustrated, and Fort was crushed. And Fort, fortunately, went back to the kitchen table and started writing again.
Yeah, he didn't give up, did he?
No, he absolutely didn't. I mean, there were certainly periods of his life where he desperately, desperately needed to sell a book. Ironically, this was not one of the times. He'd come into a little bit of money, and he was living comfortably at this time.
His uncle died and left him something.
Exactly, right? And it changed his world at that moment. He always lived very, very meagerly. He didn't need much money. He and his wife lived very simply in inexpensive apartments in New York. But when he came into this money, it just made him comfortable enough that he could go back into these subjects. And what he did was something quite remarkable.
He basically quit his day job, didn't he?
He had several small jobs to try and make ends meet, but he always was a writer. He always struggled to be a writer, and that was principally his occupation. And when he went back to the drawing board, so to speak, he ended up with a manuscript called Z, which isn't surprising since he had done X and Y. At least that was his working title. And Z was a remarkable book, because what he did with Z is he basically realized that the interest is these oddities, that they in and of themselves tell us a story about the world. And he didn't need to speculate. He didn't need to do what science had been trying to do for centuries, what philosophy had been trying to do for centuries, what great religions had been trying to do for centuries, and tie everything together. He didn't need to do that. It was enough to tell you the ghost stories about our world, and to say why is it that you're not paying attention to these things.
He would have been a great guest on the show.
He probably would have been too shy.
Really?
He was enormously shy. He ended up in the last years of his life, he was something of a hermit. He didn't like to leave his apartment in the Bronx. And when friends of his founded the Fortean Society, which we can talk about later, which is still going strong in many forms.
Sure.
I mean, obviously we hear the name Fortean today. But when some friends of his founded the Fortean Society a couple of years before Fort's death, Fort wouldn't become a member of it.
He was that shy. Jeez.
He went to the initial meeting and sat in the back and smoked a cigar and listened. But he wouldn't really have any part of it. And he was very uncomfortable in social situations. And he really felt that the books were what spoke for him.
He was 57 when he died, Jim. He didn't like modern medicine at all, did he?
No. In fact, I believe that one of the certainly he had plans to write a book about the fallacies of medicine, and he was skeptical about medical science as well as other sciences, and so he avoided any kind of
medical practice and ended up, and obviously it exacerbated his illnesses. We think he died of leukemia.
I'm guessing those days, he died in 1932. Was 57 considered a pretty ripe old age to die?
It certainly wasn't an anomaly. I can see from, in fact, I did go through tables. It certainly wasn't considered a ripe old age, but it also wasn't an anomaly for someone to die. You know, that was fairly common for someone to
die. Heck, I'm 59. I'm glad I wasn't living then.
I mean, things were really different then. And also, wow. I mean, I think if you had lived Fort's lifestyle, it might have been a little different as well.
What, was he in the fast lane?
No, quite the opposite. I mean, he lived a very sedentary lifestyle. He really wrote. He went to the library every day. And then he cut down those trips later in life.
He looks a little heavy.
He certainly was. He looks a little. I mean, I think the best way for the listeners to he looked in his youth. He looked a lot like a heavy Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah.
He had the same kind of glasses. He had the same kind of walrus mustache. Was a little heavier. Had the same kind of stern expression. He certainly wasn't very.
Healthy.
Healthy. He didn't have any kind of people sort of didn't remember him. He was a very quiet man with the kind of nervous mannerisms, very sweet, very deferential to people, very polite. He brought all those kind of mannerisms from his boyhood in Albany all through his life. But he made very little impression on people. He was very quiet, sat in the background gathering information. And again, the book spoke for him and As many earthquakes and lightning flashes as he made with those books, you know, he personally was quite the opposite of that.
Was he one of those people whose name was bigger after he died?
He certainly had a following after the Book of the Damned. I think he would be probably astonished today that his name and enormously proud that his name lives on and that the word Fortean and Fortianism has become. A noun.
He's probably up there now going, man, they're doing a show on me.
I think he would be astonished that his books have almost never been out of print since in some edition.
And I got to tell you, Jim, a number of guests always mention his name on this program over the years. Whenever we dabble in anything that has to do with the supernatural, his name always comes up.
He is the, well, I mean, we can talk about why that is. Because that's something that I write about. His books are the cue of modern books on the paranormal. They are the original source material. Now, of course, I'm saying that with some exaggeration because, of course, Fort got these from sources himself. But in gathering the material, in organizing it, in writing about it, he introduced so many of these subjects to people for the first time, and. One generation later, the Fortean writers, and they're writers that we know very well, Vincent Gaddis and, Van Doniken, it's the list of the big names. Those writers all took their cues from Fort and very often started with his subjects and just enlarged upon them.
And succeeded.
Absolutely. And many of them actually, which is why I say the man who invented the supernatural, they take his attitude about it. Which is what he invented. Before Fort, the supernatural was either one of two things. It was either sneered at by the establishment,
mm-hmm.
or it was miracle. It was a miracle. It was embraced by a kind of religious fervor.
Right.
Okay, these were things out of the ordinary. And what Fort really did in organizing these four books and putting this wealth of material together in this kind of very confusing way and then commenting wryly on it all without giving you any guidance, while kind of taking you by the hand but not telling you where you're going. What he did was he put the supernatural in our world. He basically, took all the lenses off of it. It was no longer far away from us. It was no longer too close to us. It was in our world. And he basically said, you better shake hands with this. You better pay attention to these things, and you better understand that it's happening. And how do you think this fits in? And the books present enormous challenges. And again, you're right. He does propose some ideas. He wonders whether the Earth really spins. He wonders whether it's really the size that astronomers say. He wonders if, there isn't contact with other worlds. there are many theories where some of them, they sound perfectly reasonable, and some of them, they sound humorous. You don't know how to take.
But he makes you think.
He always makes you think, because, of course, what he's basically saying is one theory is as good as another. All of these things are equal because these things aren't being explained.
How did you get interested in him?
I read Fort. I was lucky enough to find his collected works, a copy of his collected works, and I read him in high school. And it's tough going, and we can talk a little about that too, because you know some of his books that you get into sections of his books, and it's an acquired taste. Although I think in terms of literary style, he has this wonderful literary style. Once you get into the groove, it is like writing a comic.
But he is kind of complex sometimes.
There are sections of some of the books where he gets into theories, and it is very complex.
Yeah.
I think he almost did that deliberately. But I was lucky enough in high school to get a copy of his collected books, and I made it all the way through. And, of course, the phenomenon are just jaw-dropping. And part of it is the way he presents it and the way he writes about it and organizes it. And then as I explored a little more, I came across a biography of him that was published in the 1970s by Damon Knight, who was a science fiction writer and a Fortean. And there was a little biography of Fort published in the 70s. And when I read that, I realized that he was equally a puzzle. Just as the phenomenon were a puzzle, just as his literary style was a puzzle, the third part of the puzzle was this man who had this odd childhood, led this very simple, sedentary life, but somehow had been inspired to put together this new kind of literature.
At a time when nobody would understand it.
No. I mean, it really came out of nowhere. Yeah. I mean, and you can see that in all of the reviews, is that no one knew what to do with this sort of collection of material. And no one knew what to make of him. You have to understand that at the point these books came out, the name Charles Fort was absolutely unknown. People might have read his name attached to a short little story several years earlier in Argosy or in The Black Cat or one of the pulp journals.
And he got panned with some of his writings by some of the writers of the day, didn't he?
Oh, he had every review imaginable. You know, for every Booth Tarkington that you can say, for every Theodore Dreiser who said he was a genius, who said this is a new kind of book, this is absolutely remarkable, there's an H.G. Wells who says this is the biggest collection of boring material from someone who cut scraps off. There were people who truly didn't know how to make it, and it's interesting to contemplate what these reviews did to Fort, who was a very shy, very self-conscious man. But it certainly toughened him up because he was getting them for all four books. He had people who condemned them and then right next to it a review that just praised him to the skies. But I think part of that was that these books were so strikingly different that no one knew what to make of them.
That is fascinating. Well, we're going to get into a lot of his work next hour. And what I'd like to do, Jim, too, when we get to our third hour of phone calls for you, I'd like to do something a little differently, and that is have people call in with some of their bizarre stories as well, as if they were Charles Fort.
We'll talk about some of the phenomena he looked at, and that'd be interesting to compare to what they look at today.
Yeah, absolutely. And his friend, Theodore Dreiser, he was a pretty good novelist at the time, wasn't he?
He was. He had actually written the great American novel, Mr. Carey, which was what people called it at the time, right at the time he was a good friend of Fort and was helping Fort with his career.
He truly wanted Fort to succeed, didn't he?
He really wanted him to succeed, and I think Dreiser's interest in the supernatural, Dreiser thought of himself something as a metaphysician as well, and I think that friendship really fostered these interests in Fort as well. I think they're... In many ways, there wouldn't have been a Charles Fort without Theodore Dreiser.
All right. Well, Jim, you stay with us. This book is called Charles Fort, The Man Who Invented the Supernatural. Jim Steinmeier is our special guest. His website is his name, jimsteinmeier.com, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com as well. We'll be right back as we get into some of the works of Charles Fort, beginning with The Book of the Damned. That's next.